This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. A lemon of a light fixture in a Big Dig tunnel, which crashed onto the roadway weeks ago, continues to cause problems on Beacon Hill, including the ouster of a Transportation Department administrator.
He was informed early on in the investigation that there was an issue with the lights, and he failed to report that to me.
Plus, former city councilor Chuck Turner heads to prison. Here he is last night.
There has to be justice in this country.
That's right.
And there can't be justice if we allow the criminal justice system to be controlled by rogues who are operating in the interest of the oligarchy rather than the interest of the people of this country.
Thanks to Channel 5 for that audio. And by the way, just who are the people of this country, or of this state even? Well, census figures out this week showed Massachusetts is growing bigger and more diverse, and we'll dive into the numbers to just find out how diverse. Quite a week of news, and combing through it with us today is Peter Kanellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hi again, Peter.
Hello, Meghna.
How are you doing today, by the way?
Fine, thanks.
Good. It just occurs to me that I never ask you that, so I'm glad to hear you're doing well.
Thank you.
Also with us is Craig Sandler, owner and publisher of the State House News Service. Hi there, Craig.
Hi, Meghna. I'm great, by the way.
You know, you're never anything but great, which is why we love having you on the show.
Thank you.
So, Peter, let me just start with you. The census figures from Census 2010 came out this week. I guess a massaging of the numbers so we understand what they mean. They showed a large increase in both the Latino and Asian populations in Massachusetts, as well as smaller but significant increases in the African American community. So let's just start with that. Massachusetts getting more diverse. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's getting more diverse. I think the numbers also show that virtually all of the growth over the last 10 years was through immigration. And so people who recognize that, you know, our ability to expand our economy and to, you know, have a larger footprint within the United States stems in a large part from our ability to assimilate immigrants. And this has been part of the Massachusetts story for 100 years, but it certainly was a key to the last 10 years.
Craig?
Yeah, well, you know, the major dynamic of these numbers for a lot of people in the building at the State House is the way white flight continues in Massachusetts and continues to, you know, I want to be careful about saying getting worse. This is so racially charged in so many ways, and I think that sometimes we're too quick to saying white people are leaving our city. Oh, that's bad. And in fact, if you think about it, that's kind of a racist statement. So I've been thinking since these numbers came out about, just how eager I am to find out about income in cities. I want to find out if these cities became poorer as they became darker. If so, sure, that's cause for concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, can I say, question I had is, I mean, the white population did go down by 2%, but does that mean there's white flight, or is it just that the birth rate is low and that people have been dying off? I don't know that the census made clear that people were leaving.
Well, right? I think the proportions, though, are changing, right? And that there's a higher percentage of minorities in these cities. And, you know, I mean, it's classic. It always has been in Massachusetts that you get poor people in the center of any urban area, and over time you can see ripples going out. You know, the Jewish population of Boston became the Jewish population of Brookline as Jews thrived, and so ripples are good. I just really want to find out whether the quality of life in these cities is dropping. And you know, desirable families are leaving, or whether it's being portrayed literally too much in black and white.
Well, Peter, actually, to follow up on your question of whether or not the census numbers show if white people are actually leaving the state, if we sort of, you know, take our telescope out and zoom into Boston in particular, we find that Boston's even more of a minority majority city than it was in 2000. Which is, I mean, depending on your point of view, that does that mean that more whites are leaving the city or not?
Well, it's difficult to cut the information. I mean, there's no clear answer from the census bureaus. I think that what it means is that minorities and immigrants tend to be attracted to cities, which is something that we've known for a long time, mm-hmm. and there are economic reasons for that. It's also much easier to assimilate. You know, we know here in Boston there are several communities, the Asian community, the Southeast Asian community, the Hispanic community, where people cluster together. Obviously, they're bringing relatives and friends in, yep. and things like that. There's nothing particularly insidious about that if they then make a larger percentage of the population. And, you know, if the white population goes down, it may not be that people are fleeing because the quality of life isn't good. it in right. Boston. It may be that certain families are dying out, and you know, whatever. It's a it's a more complicated equation.
Exactly, and it can be, you know, it can really be those ripples. You can hear in this back and forth between Peter and I how the conversation is just starting with the release of the numbers, and that's why, for you know, it's not about geeks, it's about people who care about the quality of life in this state or anywhere in the country. These numbers really are conversation starters.
Well, listeners, what do you make of the new census figures and what they tell us about Boston, about your town, about the state of Massachusetts? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or call about any of the week's news that caught your eye. Before we leave the issue of the census, though, you know, obviously one of the reasons why people love to dig into these numbers is the politics of the numbers.
Do tell.
So you, right. No, Craig, you tell us. What does this mean for in terms of like the big redistricting fight that we're going to have in the state?
I mean, as with everything, it's complex because there's a lot of ways to interpret the numbers. But basically, Worcester County got more important in this census. The way that I like to think about it, and this is partly just being a statehouse dork, but
or entirely,
I just feel like we're entering the epoch of Tim Murray. I thought the lieutenant governor, and he's from Worcester, former mayor, and he gave an overlooked, but I thought extremely good speech on an inauguration day just a few weeks ago, and that was the beginning of his campaign. He will certainly run for governor, and he's from Worcester. It just sort of, to me, that was a harbinger. In terms of Congress, we're going down one seat.
Right.
Somebody's going to lose their job if nobody retires, and Barney Frank said he's not going to retire, which a lot of people expected him to do. So it's hard to take the numbers and say now we can predict who's going to come out worse in this redistricting process. But the fact is, Worcester, there's no question that the central part of the state picked up clout.
Well, Peter, I mean, are you willing to sort of prognosticate as to which one of our representatives might be getting a little nervous?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm still stunned by that age of Tim Murray thing. I think it actually does not change the redistricting equation. I mean, the probably the best bet, if you were just purely speculating, is that somewhere in the Tierney, Frank, Tsongas district, there may be one that could be lost, or conceivably some combination of the Neal and Olver districts out in the west. Those might be the scenarios that would be there. But it's really, really too early to tell. And the change in the numbers, I don't think, changes the way the districts are configured so much. You know,
I want to quickly point out that although there was some complaining about the failure to set up an independent commission on redistricting, it's been somewhat encouraging, particularly compared to last time, to see the way they're conducting the process this time. They're starting with a meeting in Springfield tomorrow. And if you look at how this process is shaping up compared to past ones, you got to be a little bit encouraged about transparency and fairness and process.
Well, for us, that's all we're going to do regarding the census and redistricting today, because next up,
I think it's a problem not just for you all, but for me, that the facts sort of trickle out in bits and pieces.
Oh, I'm in London.
I know we're going to get letters about this because it's a very serious issue, but it's Friday. I'm trying to have a little bit fun because there's, of course, the big blow-up over the big light blowout in the Tip O'Neill Tunnel and the Big Dig, and the latest development today about that light that did fall down more than 6 weeks ago. Acting Highway Administrator Frank Tramontazzi resigns. And Craig Sandler, this is a story. It started small, but it just keeps growing.
I had to get my big in there. And this is pretty big news, but of course the big G's didn't step down, did he? Nor was he fired. And
Jeff Mullen, Transportation Secretary.
Thanks. It's not clear that it ends there. I don't know whether they're trying to make the buck stop with that administrator, but it feels incomplete, and Patrick has not signaled that it's complete with this resignation.
Well, here is Transportation Secretary Jeff Mullen today after announcing Tramontazzi's resignation.
At the time, I didn't believe that the internal breakdown in communication was an important matter that the public would be interested in, and
clearly they are interested in it. I think that the public is more interested in having its leaders take responsibility, which is what I've been trying to do.
Peter Canellis, I mean, Jeff Mullen there, first he had said that, okay, a month elapsed before Governor Patrick was told that the light fell. He took responsibility for that. Then he said, wait, but my staff didn't even tell me for a month. I mean, this just seems like there's a breakdown in communication, and does one resignation suffice in this case?
I think it's a close call, but I think, yes, probably it does. I think that Jeff Mullen has been fairly quick to come out and say this was a mistake. It's very clear that it was a mistake. I think if you put yourself in sort of his position, you know, he probably was notified quite late. By the time he was notified, he was quite reassured that there was not a danger to the public. So therefore, you know, his decision to wait an extra week or two before notifying the public is a little bit less egregious than the initial decision not to notify the mm-hmm. public before they knew whether these things were falling left and right. So I would give Mullen the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, you know, I actually used to cover transportation for WBUR, and I've interviewed Jeff Mullen several times. And you know, when he first became Secretary of Transportation, I'll admit I was actually surprisingly refreshed by how much of a straight shooter I found him to be, Craig.
That's why he's still got his job, by the way. And people like Brad Jones, the minority leader in the House, have supported him because he is well regarded and well liked. And ironically, you know why? He's been really communicative, particularly with mayors and the reps, and so it is a kind of a strange irony in that regard.
Well, but still, he's overseeing the transportation department, which has its legacy with the big dig of problems. So you'd think that in the same system of tunnels where a woman died, that at least people in the department would be more on top of things say, "Hey, we've got to tell people ASAP that this happened."
Excuse me, you should know that 100-pound things are dropping off your 3-year-old tunnel. And if you can't even get your communication straight in that regard, you know, what else do you not know is loose? People are just, that's not, you know, demagoguery. People are justified in thinking if you're not capable of shooting straight on your first chance and you don't seem to have your lines of communication straight, what else don't you have straight? And it's literally a matter of life and death.
And Peter Canellis, let me ask you, in terms of all this communication or miscommunication or lack of communication, going on. There's also the ongoing story of Fidelity Investments from, you know, last week not talking to Governor Patrick before they pull 1,100 jobs out of Marlboro. But today the head of Fidelity, you know, or recently saying, yes, I have spoken with the governor. Where do you see Governor Patrick in all of this, where much of the news, not all of it, but much of it is, you know, him reacting to the news because he's finding out, you know, on the front pages of the newspaper or on WBUR?
Well, my initial feeling was that it was a good point that Patrick was making, that you know, as a courtesy, Fidelity being a big employer, having a lot of dealings with the state, actually getting part of the mutual fund tax break that was enacted in 1996, that they should have informed the governor. But I do think Patrick has carried that issue a little bit too far. Mm. And with his, you know, statements of outrage and his demands that people come in and talk to him, he's creating this sort of unrealistic expectation that every time a company moves or a job is cut, that somehow it's the governor's fault, or that the businesses are supposed to go in and deal directly with him. I think it's going to blow up in his face in a lot of ways, because people will be losing their jobs because of changes in various industries and blaming the governor for it.
But on the other hand, I'll stand in his defense today, because originally I said, you know, is it the responsibility in one of our meetings here of companies to talk to the governor? But then I thought, well, you know, he is the champion for the state's economic future. That's how he's cast himself.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's going abroad to say, you know, I'm the one who's going to bring jobs here. So him not knowing does seem to be kind of putting him in a rough patch.
You're
but
right.
A couple of, well, I want to also make one point, though, and that is that a lot of the people who are occupying those jobs will be able to continue to occupy them because they're moving like 15 and 20 miles away, right across the state line to other offices of Fidelity. So Patrick's peak is that the state will lose tax revenues and stuff too. So it's a little different. It's not like he's standing up for the little guy exactly. He's sort of standing up for the state tax base and stuff. It's a queasy situation, I think.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, number one, what you want to be doing is announcing new jobs, not scampering after people. And it comes in the context of being away when Japan happened and there were concerns raised about Pilgrim nuclear plant, the light fixture, and not knowing about that. That's obviously been talked about enough. But I will point out that that story sort of broke as though he were chasing Abigail J. Johnson around. And you don't want to come across like that, especially if you're spending more and more time criticizing Mitt Romney.
Well, lastly today, in our Week in Review, turned a little more serious news. I mean, it's all serious. But City Councilor Chuck Turner, he is headed for prison today. Here he is last night speaking. We get the sound from Channel 5.
There has to be justice in this country.
That's right.
And there can't be justice if we allow the criminal justice system to be controlled by rogues who are operating in the interest of the oligarchy rather than the interest of the people of this country.
Peter Kanellis, is today the end of the story or just the beginning?
Well, it depends how much longer people keep quoting Chuck Turner in these crazy rants of his. I mean, I think that kind of a statement is sad and unfortunate in two ways. One, it shows for just how long the district that he represented in Roxbury has been misserved by somebody who's busy railing against the oligarchy rather than doing the hard work that we want city councilors to do to improve the neighborhood. And I think that he was a very poor city councilor. Now, secondly, he did himself no favors whatsoever during this whole process by screaming and yelling about the oligarchy when there was actual evidence of him, you know, taking money from somebody. You know, it was a totally documented situation.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, now there's the question of whether he's being punished too much, whether there's a racial disparity and all that. It's really unfortunate, I think, if people dwell on it. Now, we don't know all the information that the judge had. I haven't looked at every single corruption case to see whether this was an egregious sentence, but he deserved a stiff sentence because of his total lack of responsibility or taking responsibility for this incident. Whether it was too much or not is a question people can debate.
Craig?
It plays badly with the Wilkerson case. Kudos to Andrew Ryan of the Globe today for breaking the story about Turner's emails. And, of course, it's juxtaposed on the pages of the Globe with the story of Sal DeMasi's defense being paid for by us. You know, the climate is it contributes to a climate in which people are more and more disheartened, and that's too bad because there's a lot of important problems that we have, and it's harder and harder to solve them the more and more cynical people get.
Well, that's all for Peter, sorry to interrupt you, but I was going to just say that that's all for the news that we're covering this week. But you can't have another say in just a second because it is time for our weekly hubbub, the stories that didn't make it into this conversation. I'm going to bring Anthony Brooks, my co-host, back in here. Anthony, your hubbub?
Hi there, Meghna. Hi there, Peter. Hi there, Hi. Craig. So here's my hubbub. It's a story that we actually did report this week, but there's more to say about it. It comes from the great state of Maine and that controversy over the mural at the Department of Labor. As you'll recall, Governor LePage created a bit of a shrieking controversy up in Maine when he ordered that this mural at the state's Department of Labor be taken down. The reason he says the mural is one-sided, it sends a pro-labor message. The story has gone viral, this latest eruption in the battle against organized labor. And last night, John Stewart picked it up on The Daily Show. And I just want to play his take on it because it's so amusing.
A Department of Labor with a mural celebrating labor. Now I've seen everything. By the way, the mural's one-sided. Do you understand how murals work? Generally, it's a two-dimensional planed art form.
So that's it. I mean, just that. Do you understand how a mural works? What is a politically balanced mural? What does that look like? It's a new art form that has yet to be developed.
You need
but I'm
special
sure we'll
glasses.
Get there. Yeah.
Peter Kanellis, your hubbub.
I'll mention a real heart warmer. The woman who, a month after her house burned, found her dog, who she had believed was out somewhere roaming around. The dog was actually in the house, found in the house a month after the fire. Ought to give hope to a lot of pet owners out there.
There's a whole control room of people behind the glass going, "Oh."
Yeah. And not so fast, Kanellis. The reason the dog made it so long is he was so young, so it doesn't give this crowd that
Yeah, but he might have. No. He might have also eaten some cat food from the neighbors, right?
Oh, there
he's young and resourceful.
Yeah. Well played, sir.
Craig, your hubbub.
I got to go with the outdated food in the Boston schools only because I'm not so old that I can't remember how painful the whole subject of school lunches was anyway. And I actually admire the kids. I thought they were really articulate, explaining why this is actually a serious issue. And you really got a feel for them. And again, it's another point where, come on, government, let's get it right. Get things like this right. Those are the baby steps, I think, that can turn around perceptions of government. So,
good point.
You know.
Well, finally, my hubbub came about because this morning I was like digging around in my files, trying to find my W-2s, trying to find all my bank statements, thinking, should I use TurboTax? Should I use Tax Act? You know, like we're pushing the envelope in terms of the deadline's April 15th, right?
Yes, sir. This
so
is
I'm,
tax
I'm sweating over taxes.
I think you have until the 18th this year.
The 18th. Okay. Yeah. Well, then I open up the paper and I find, oh, but wait. If you earn $14 billion in profit, $5 billion of which are in the United States, and you are the world's or one of the world's largest corporations, and your name is General Electric, you pay no taxes in the United States because you have some of the best accountants, including one who's a former Treasury official, working to be sure that you pay no federal taxes. And the New York Times said the company slogan, imagination at work, really fits the tax department at GE very, very well. So that's my hubbub for today. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Megan. Same to you.
Craig Sandler, publisher and owner of the Statehouse News Service, always great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Enjoy.
Coming up, your letters, and later in the show, what's so funny about classical music? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston.